Welcome to this leadership forum of the Institute, to all my now fellow actuaries. The subject is the actuary in the boardroom. There are three of us on the panel who are speaking. I'm not going to introduce my colleagues, they'll introduce themselves, and I'm going to kick off on the first subject. My name is Ian Pollard. Actually, I'm timekeeper today, so I'd better get this out and start off on a good basis myself. So I'm Ian Pollard. I've been a company director basically throughout my professional career. And the first company I was a director of, I was chairman of it, and I was about 25. And my two co-directors were 23. And the company was one which absolutely revolutionised music. It was the first... It achieved the first ever digitisation of sound and the manipulation of that so that, for example, you could play a dog barking up and down a keyboard, and it produced the world's greatest musical synthesizer for a period of about 10 years. That was great fun. And ultimately the company went broke. But that was the beginnings of my career as a non-executive director. I've been a director of about 30 different companies across all sorts of industries, a number of them being financial institutions and highly regulated organisations, and others being startups. I'm currently a director, I'm chairman of RGA in Australia, a life reinsurer. I'm a director of Milton Corporation, which is a listed investment company, virtually zero risk and just has a portfolio of a couple of billion dollars of investments. And I'm a director of the Wentworth Group of Concerned Scientists. I may mention some of the other companies I've been involved with as I speak later. The first subject on our agenda is the role and the composition of the board. And so what is the role of a board? Basically, it will vary. Well, while certain there are certain provisions of, in for example, the Corporations Act or other legislation as to what a board must do, at the end of the day, it varies widely between companies. Depends on whether they're startups or whether they're listed companies, what industries they're in, etc. But at the end of the day, probably the most important single job is the appointment of the chief executive. If you get the wrong chief executive, you're in for trouble. If you get the right chief executive, life will generally be more fruitful for all stakeholders. And linked to that also is the appointment of the chairman. And linked to all of that are decisions regarding remuneration, particularly remuneration philosophy and the incentives that will drive the place, which is linked to risk management. And those of you who work in regulated, APRA-regulated organisations will realise or know that that's a significant aspect of board responsibilities. The next thing is to do with strategy, very fundamental. The board's role, I don't think, is to be the absolute driver of strategy. It's more to be the confirmer and challenger of strategy if you've got good management capable of determining it in the first place. You've got to assess the resources for the business, you know, people, systems, capital, etc. And part of that then is approving and monitoring major expenditure on things, on capital expenditure on things like systems or big projects. You've got to monitor the business on a monthly, say, basis in its performance against strategy, and at generally annual periods or maybe semi-annual periods, you've got to audit what's happening and get some external input to check that what you think's happening is happening, and then report that to the stakeholders. And that's a very important part of the board's relationship, the communication with the stakeholders. There are significant compliance roles, which, as I mentioned, in regulated institutions, you'll be very conscious of most of those. But in wider companies, or in all companies at the end of the day, but not as significantly in financial institutions, you've got big issues of occupational health and safety, excuse me, environmental issues and trade practices issues. So at the end of the day, there's a challenge of balancing compliance issues and performance issues and the attention you give to both. But one of the things that I'd really like to point out about a board role is at the end of the day, it's not generally about action or about producing bits of paper or about doing calculations. It's about deliberating, thinking deeply and discussing deeply things which management have produced. And then there are a couple of areas where, particularly in listed companies, the board's role really comes heavily to the fore, and that is in subjects like capital raisings and in considering takeover offers for shareholders. So that's a quick overview of the role of the board. What's a composition of the board that might be well-structured to handle that? Again, varies widely, but a few core principles. The first is to have a range of skills round the table. There's no point having 10 people round a table and 8 of them being very, very similar. But the most significant skills are for a number of people around the table to have a good understanding of what's involved in governing a company and the responsibilities that go with it. And the second is to have genuine industry experience represented around the table. I mentioned diversity a moment ago. Fundamental diversity of experience, diversity of gender, diversity in any way is generally of advantage, provided the people around the table are able to communicate and get on the same wavelength. And that's where the role of the chairman is vital in all that. In the context of diversity, I'd like to tell you a story of a company I was chairman of years ago. I'd helped this company raise capital, and they were looking for an independent chairman. And one of the guys said, well, why can't Ian be that? And there seemed to be reasonable consensus about that. But there was one bloke who raised serious questions about it, because at the time I was the lucky recipient of a class action of $600 million and whatever. And this happened to involve the major client of this company. And so the only person who challenged that was a 25-year-old who would come to meetings in his thongs, perhaps not even with his thongs, straight from the surf, and would bring his dog to meetings on the end of a chain. But what I've got to say is that my regard for this young chap was enormous, and he was the only one who had either the combination of awareness and courage or whatever to ask that question. So anyway, a few introductory comments. I'll now pass over Anthony to continue this in the not-for-profit area.
Thanks, Ian. So for those who don't know me, my name's Anthony Lowe. I'm currently the Chief Executive of the Prostate Cancer Foundation of Australia, and I'm here to say I think my chairman made a brilliant choice in appointing me, Ian. And as Ian said, I primarily actually want to talk about not-for-profits and frankly make a plug for you all to get involved in the not-for-profit world. Just a little bit about myself. I started my actuarial career at what was then R. Watson and Sons in London Road, Reigate. I was a partner there for a while. Came out to Australia in the early 90s and worked for Watson Wyatt and for AMP for a while. And for the last 10 years of my kind of actuarial career, I worked for Mercer, both here in Australia and in the US. And I was ultimately an executive director at Mercer and in charge of their superannuation and financial planning business in Asia Pacific, so primarily here in Australia, but New Zealand and Hong Kong as well. In mid-2000s, I decided I would like to do something different in my career, and I got myself a job as Chief Operating Officer at the National Breast Cancer Foundation, and from that to be Chief Executive of Prostate Cancer Foundation Australia. So the first thing I wanted to say is that not-for-profits have some similarities and some differences for for-profits, and there's a reason for that. And the reason is because not-for-profits are mission-driven organisations, and that's very important. If you do find yourself on a board of a not-for-profit, it's very important to understand the mission of the organisation. Just to illustrate that, my wife is a marketing manager at Fred Hollows Foundation, and their mission, or their vision, sort of related, is for a world where no one's needlessly blind and Indigenous Australians enjoy the same health and life expectancy as other Australians. That's kind of easy to say, but the point is this, which is all of us in financial services are used to going into businesses and going, that's not efficient, we should outsource that, we won't do that, we'll shut that down. But you can't do that in a not-for-profit organisation because the mission is everything. So Fred Hollows can't suddenly decide it's not efficient to look after Indigenous Australians because it's part of their DNA and it's actually part of Fred Hollows' vision himself. So that leads to some differences. Probably the main difference that you'll see is not-for-profit boards are typically much larger than for-profit boards. Ian, I think you mentioned maybe 8-10 people around the boardroom table.
Or even less.
Yeah, we have a board of 18 people, and that's not uncommon. So the first thing, if you find yourself in a not-for-profit board, is don't get all agitated about the fact the board's too big. My board has representation from business. My chairman actually is the managing director of Finity Consulting, David Sando. And it has a number of business people on it. Obviously, as you'd expect, it's got a number of urological surgeons on the board. We've also got a Rotarian and various members of the community because we're a community organisation. So the first thing is that boards are typically much bigger. That makes them more complicated to manage because you've got a huge diversity of kind of life experience and opinion on the board. And they typically have large numbers of subcommittees as well. So you often find a large number of subcommittees. We've got a support group subcommittee, awareness and education subcommittee, a finance and operations subcommittee, a research advisory committee that manages our research program, and on and on. And we typically throw up committees at a drop of a hat to deal with a particular problem as well. So it's a different world, I'll talk a bit more about that as we go through. But I would encourage you to think about the possibility not just of being on the board of a bank or an insurance company, but to think about your interests in life and what the not-for-profit sector adds to the community and the possibility of bringing your skills to bear on a not-for-profit board. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Elaine Collins, and our next topic is really why next year you might be interested in NED roles and what they might contribute. But before I talk about that, I will give my own introduction. I have just retired from the Deloitte Partnership a month ago on 30 June with a specific view to seeking non-executive director roles. I'm intending to start in the general insurance industry because that is where my experience lies and that's the industry that knows me as well. But I can also see how to move into a career as a non-executive director on a full-time basis, one would need to be in a number of different industries, not just one industry, or the roles would conflict. I've been a statutory actuary for 11 years, 5 years at KPMG and 6 years at Deloitte, so I thought it was a good time to change direction. My experience has been very much in general insurance, so a very specific experience rather than a wide range of industries. But I'm using that as a strength because it then gives me a very deep knowledge of the general insurance industry. I've been a statutory actuary in Singapore and Australia, so and done valuations in PNG and so on, so covered a number of countries, a number of different lines of business, so PI, PL, motor, home, lenders, mortgage insurance, consumer credit. So out of sort of that 11 years, it's given me a really broad overview of the different lines of business that underwritten, I guess, different distribution channels, different strategies by different companies in different countries. So when one steps back, it gives you a sort of a good overview of what the actuarial numbers mean. I've also been involved on the institute side, and I think we can't not consider that because that's an important part of our being a well-rounded actuary, I think. I've been on a number of committees, but at the moment I'm on the Professional Standards Committee, and that committee is very much involved with reviewing the professional standards that get brought up for all the different practice areas, industries that actuaries work in, and making sure there's consistency and they make sense and they are saying one thing rather than having double meanings in the wordings. So those sorts of things, I think, are all good contributions to being an actuary and being able to contribute to business. So I think those sort of aspects of one's experience are all important ones. I have also had a lot of involvement in media appearances, mainly in the last couple of years. I think the count is more than 120 now. And I think that side of needing to communicate with, not necessarily with the media, but with a number of different stakeholders is also an important side of being an actuary and being able to add value, because that communication side of things, I think, is really, really important. There are a number of areas where I think an actuary might contribute to a board. One is capital and risk. I mean, I'm thinking very much on the general insurance side, the insurance side, and particularly timing-wise, I'm thinking of it now because APRA are bringing in new capital standards for life insurance and general insurance, and so companies have to then rethink the statutory capital requirements as well as, you know, their own economic capital requirements and thoughts, and potentially if they're owned by head office, you know, the capital that the head office is willing to send down to them, the kind of return on capital they need to make. Companies really need to follow up all of those questions, and I think actuaries have a very good overview of capital and risk and the linkage between the two. The industry doesn't always link the two very well. They sort of think of prudential capital requirements on one hand and the risk of underwriting the products on the other hand, and perhaps putting some restrictions on underwriters and not necessarily linking the two, because, you know, a line of business can be very profitable, but if it requires a huge load of capital to underwrite it, it may not be something that you want to expand your footprint in. So I think the linking of capital and risk is one really good contribution that actuaries can make to boards. The second is a deep and wide knowledge of a particular industry. Some actuaries are like me, that have a very deep knowledge of one industry, such as general insurance or life insurance. Others are more spread across different industries, but I think having a very deep knowledge of one industry and understanding what competitors are thinking and how the whole industry is thinking, and even the cycles over the last 10 or 20 years, just the fact that you've been through those and you've seen what's happened to companies, and there's so many things you've heard before, you know, that portfolio would have been really profitable if it wasn't for those, you know, five large claims and so on. So those sorts of things that one hears year after year, that just leads to, you know, a good understanding of what it might imply for the future. The third is understanding the implications of actuarial reports. I know that there's been a lot of sort of support for actuarial reports becoming more communicative of the key issues rather than just, you know, saying the answer is 51,422,564. What are the implications of that number? What does it actually mean? What does it mean for the business that's been underwritten in the last year? And what does it mean for the strategy of the company? Should they change their strategy going forward? Does it have capital implications? I think the implications of those actuarial reports, it's important to understand them, and I think that an actuary being on the board will assist the board to understand what the implications are and how things might need to change. My fourth point is, I think actuaries have a different way of thinking about issues, and as Ian was mentioning earlier, a diversified board is very useful, because if everyone's thinking the same and coming to the same conclusions, there's not going to be some, if there might be a big issue, that's a big problem, and no one's going to think of it. Whereas I think actuaries, in their training and their analytical work, the result of that over a number of years gives actuaries a different way of thinking, and that provides a different perspective to board discussion. And why discussion in the boardroom leads to effective board decision making, you know, as opposed to everyone thinking the same.
I'll just follow on from Elaine's comments, just perhaps re wider industries. So, dealing first with the question of why might an actuary be interested in working in another as a director in another industry. Firstly, I think it can be incredibly exciting learning about new industries, and that'll vary from one to the next. But I've got to say, in my experience, it almost hasn't mattered what the industry is. At the end of the day, it can be really exciting if you've got a management team that is passionate about it. And I was involved years ago in a business called Expermet, which was a metal bashing business. Basically, it had one product, which was called expanded metal, that was steel or aluminium that had been sliced by a machine and then stretched in these enormous presses. Anyway, I was involved with the company for something like 15 or 20 years, and I drove my kids crazy and my wife crazy, because no matter where we were in Australia or anywhere around the world, I could spot some expanded metal at about 200 metres. And they also can now. It was used for safety protection on equipment. If you go down the snow, you won't slip on the walkways because it's used there. A range of different things. But I developed that enthusiasm, excuse me, for it simply because the challenge for this business was nobody would buy this product unless it was sort of sold to them, or they could suddenly envisage an application for it. So it was, to me, an incredibly exciting business, yet on another measure could be considered absolutely mundane. But I've been involved in more exciting ones like the Fairlight computer musical instrument I described earlier. And probably the business that I've been most excited about in all my professional career is one which is now owned by Lendlease, which is a company called Delphin Property Group, and they've just stopped that brand in the last 6 months. But it was basically the world's greatest company in the area of development of big urban communities. And I still have the absolute fondest of memories of going down to Adelaide, to where we'd just got the responsibility for developing an area where 30,000 people were going to live. And this was just sort of hills on the outside of Adelaide, arguably one of Australia's most difficult property markets. But I got an enormous buzz out of seeing there the innovative work that they were doing. Having this very long-term project on which they could work, they could do things that nobody had ever done before, like putting together three high schools to share common facilities. So they had a government school, a Protestant school and a Catholic school, all sharing. They each had their own big oval, but they shared places where you could learn to be a mechanic, or library facilities, etc. The economies of scale of this, the interaction resulting from it, etc., absolutely fundamental for the development of these communities. And I was involved in those sort of projects for 20 or 25 years with them, including the going out to Moore Park when the lights were first put up there, the lights out at the SCG for Packers Cricket Circus that you can now watch television about at the moment, I gather. They were wanting to have them in Adelaide, right in the middle of this property development that we'd just started. And so royal commissions and whatever. But I got a big buzz out of seeing things grow. And I had the same out of a company called Amity, which started off with three blokes working in a little office, and they ended up building Australia's largest aged care business, which is now owned by Bupa. But they built that up from absolutely nothing. So seeing the people grow and seeing the businesses grow is probably the biggest single excitement of being a director of a company. It's also very interesting because it gives you a different perspective. As a full-time employee somewhere, you generally are looking at quite a lot of detail. Your head's down right in the midst of it. It's a single industry situation, perhaps. Whereas as a non-executive director coming in to perhaps a number of different places, you get a more global view of things that are happening, and something you learn from one company maybe of validity somewhere else. And at the end of the day, you can choose what you sign up for. You don't, nobody's obliging you to be a non-executive director of Company X. You can choose amongst the opportunities as they arise. What might you contribute? I think it's very much the same things that Elaine has just described. And I've listed a few here, but I don't think I'll go through those in any detail. But probably one of the key things that people are looking for from you all collectively is uninhibited frankness and and good commercial judgment and the ability to work as a team with the other people around the table, and to sort of respect that there aren't any geniuses amongst all of us, and we need each other to come up with the right conclusions for the company. And I must say, I've learned over the years that one of the things I really like is to see my colleagues coming up with brilliant questions that I'd never even thought of, whereas probably years ago I was the other way around, thinking, well, how can I come up with a brilliant question that might impress my colleagues? I've given up trying to do that. But the satisfaction comes in being around a table with wonderful people and interesting people.
So what might you contribute to a not-for-profit board? I think most actuaries would think, well, obviously it's going to be my financial skills, and that certainly is something that you contribute. It might come as a surprise to learn that generally people who comment on the not-for-profit industry feel that the wrong place for somebody with a financial background to start in a not-for-profit board is on the finance committee. And the reason for that comes back to what I was saying about mission. We run not-for-profit organisations in a way where if we had more money, we could always do more. And so we're always running them on a shoestring, and we're always taking what you guys would probably regard as risky financial decisions. We're running very close to the edge. And so the big danger, many people think, is to come in for a not-for-profit, apply all that great financial discipline and go, oh, we can't be doing that, need to make that more efficient, sack those staff, cut that down, outsource that to India, and so on and so forth. The general recommendation is to come in and be involved in a more mission-oriented committee, one of those many committees that I talked about. So there are great things that you can contribute to a board from your own personal experience and your business knowledge and so on and so forth. And certainly the financial side of it is one of them. But there are, you know, happenstance things that you can contribute as well. From my point of view, I often get asked, what do I contribute as chief executive to the Prostate Cancer Foundation as an actuary? And certainly, you know, my knowledge of running business units at Mercer and so on for a long period of time. We run a research program, and we raise the money for fund the research grants before we award the grants. Those grants are typically 3 to 5 years, so it's a fairly simple actuarial reserving problem to build the reserves to fund those grants. But I tell you, people who aren't actuaries don't necessarily think about the need to do those things. And then, as it happens, I did a maths degree. I trained as an actuary. I've obviously done statistics in my background, although I'm fundamentally a theoretical physicist, but I have a lot to do in cancer control with epidemiologists, and so I can talk to epidemiologists, I know what they're talking about, and probably more importantly, I know where the weaknesses in their arguments, if you like, because everybody sees the world through their own lens, and epidemiologists and evidence-based medicine certainly do, and the ability to see where they've got a strong point and also where some of the weaknesses are, I think, is very important. So I'd encourage everybody to think more broadly than just I'm an actuary, so clearly what I'm going to contribute is finance or risk management skills.
I'm just going to speak on the subject of how boards go about finding new non-executive directors. And that can occur in steady-as-you-go situations where there's just a normal rotation of some directors from time to time, or it can occur in one-off situations where there are changes in the ownership of a company, and in particular, for example, the public flotation of a company. But probably the most basic starting point for it all is a skills matrix, some sort of just a little table that'll say, well, okay, what are the core skills that are needed for this business, for example, in marketing and finance or legal or supply chain and logistics or IT and so on, and identifying those and saying, well, okay, out of the existing board, which boxes do we have well ticked and which ones are gaps that we would like to fill? So that's probably the starting point, followed by a job description, which is just a healthy discipline for probably all the roles you hold. Then most likely these days, contact with a search firm who'll draw up a long list. And then with the engagement with the company, they'll probably cut that down to a short list, And there will be a subcommittee of the board, often called the nominations committee, to do the interviews with that shortlist. And if I had to sum up in one point amongst the decisions I've been involved in, renew appointments of directors, what would be the single predominant factor? It would be the quality of engagement with the person in interview. And that's probably a broad-ranging term, which is something to do with their knowledge, but at the end of the day, their ability to engage with you on whatever subject broadly related to the business. And I'd just like to tell a quick story, because this may be helpful to you at some time, not in the context of non-executive director appointments necessarily, but maybe in wider contexts. I was chairman of a listed company for about 5 or 6 years, and about halfway through that period we decided we wanted two new directors, one to be an expert in logistics and supply chain, and the other to be an expert in IT. And we went to a search firm. They produced a short list of 15, which sounds like a long short list, but that was what we needed to look at, given the quality of people who were excellent and the fact that we were looking for two positions with quite different characteristics. What was fascinating to me was that out of those 15 people, all of whom had outstanding CVs, they cut themselves down to a short list of three, in my view, based on only two criteria. And these are the two that I'd encourage you to remember next time you're going for an interview anywhere. Number one is, had they done their homework properly? And we had really spoon-fed them by sending a whole lot of stuff to every one of them. But had they done their homework properly? Or was it obvious they'd done their homework? And the second one was, did we really get the feeling that they wanted the job? Now, to me, that's astonishing, that out of 15 candidates, it ends up with three that only meet those criteria. So it made it, at the end of the day, an incredibly easy decision for what we thought was going to be a very hard one. Thank you.
Yeah, I was just going to add that in my experience over the last couple of months, I have also noticed exactly what Ian's saying, that boards have a skills matrix and they know the kinds of skills they're looking for people to be on their boards. And, you know, they're looking for a variety of skills. But I think a very important part too is the behavioural aspects, that even though you need some robust discussion in the end, you need the board to come to a decision. You can't have people that are just going to keep arguing forever, because, in the end, the ideal board is covering a wide range of topics and issues and problems that could arise, but in the end coming to a decision based on all the sort of pros and cons of the different ways of going forward. So I think even though they do have that skills matrix, they're very much looking for someone that can work with the board, with them. I've also noticed that what they try and do, they do have rotation policies, and it's sometimes a difficult job to match the availability of the person that they're talking to with the skills matrix and the timing of the rotation. So boards have to work with those sort of difficulties too.
I've only got one thing to say, which is get out more. So networking is extremely important, and I know in my time in financial services, mainly the people I knew were the people that I worked with, or the people that I used to work with who went to some other company. And if you do aspire to get on a board, then I think it's extremely important that, you know, if you think you want to be on a board in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, then think thoughtfully about broadening your network and outside financial services. So, you know, we all meet people in our everyday life, suppliers, interesting people, people in activities that we do outside of work, and I think it's very important to build a broad network.
Well, Anthony's comments are a very good entree onto the next topic, which is launching an NED career. And the first thing I wanted to say was that the main way I launched my have started to launch my NED career over the last couple of months has been talking to my current clients and colleagues about what I want to do. And this has been amazingly fruitful. I've had a number of opportunities come my way from by simply undertaking that action. So I was getting out more, exactly what Anthony said we need to do. So I've now ended up with, I already have one invitation to join the board of a general insurer, and I have some other opportunities that I'm following up because clearly I'm going to end up with conflicts. One can't take everything. So... It's certainly people who know you, people who have worked with you, people who see the value you can add are going to be far more likely to ask you to join their boards than people who have never met you before. So I do think that that one's own network is surprisingly fruitful. People keep asking me over the last 2 months, have you joined LinkedIn? Jeez, I can't even keep up with what I'm trying to follow up without joining LinkedIn. So I haven't joined LinkedIn. I haven't gone to any consultancy firms. Recruitment firms. Not that those aren't necessarily good things to do. It's just ended up that I have found the best way to start the process is within one's own network. So could be different for other people, but that's certainly been my experience. I've also undertaken a 5-day director course with the Australian Institute of Company Directors, the AICD, and that was a great course. I really found it valuable. It was a 5-day course. There was a different presenter for each of the 5 days, so we sort of got to interact with a professional non-executive director each day. And each of them had about 4 or 5 non-executive director roles, and they said that pretty much kept them full-time busy. So I think that about 4 or 5 roles is sort of equivalent to a full-time job, and those roles are generally in 4 or 5 different industries. And one of them, it seems to be a good balance, seems to be one not-for-profit board and sort of 3 or 4 for-profit boards. That seems to be sort of their balance, and that seems to be most equivalent to a full-time job. So putting together a portfolio like that would take time. I can see, you know, that certainly would, particularly going into new industries, you know, as Ian's talking about, that's very exciting and so on, but people need to know you and see what you can actually contribute to that new industry. So I can see how that is something that they all sought was some new industries as well. I've got one story on the AICD course that the different 5 presenters we had, one presenter on the last day was, I guess some of the course outline was certainly the role of the board, duties of directors, they covered that to a large extent. Risk management was one, was also a half day. Strategy was another half day. Accounting, which you'll all be excited to hear. We had a whole day on accounting. I think the Centro case was something that was very much top of mind for everybody, so they wanted to make sure that we all realised that directors can't leave the accounting stuff to other fellow directors. All directors need to be on top of those sorts of things.
Or
your auditors, absolutely, David. So, and then the 4th day was legal responsibilities. You know, clearly there's almost everything that you can be not only the board sued for, which would potentially be covered under the D&O policy, but almost everything you can be personally sued for as well as a director. So Thursday was a very scary day. And then the 5th day was we were boards, and so we sort of carried out board. We were actually acting as directors sort of on the last day. So I found a really good course. It was diversified, and the presenters were really interesting. And the presenter on the last day was talking about there's different views on boards. There's the structuralists who want to make sure that they've got the different skill sets all organised on the board. They're the behavioralists that want to make sure they obtain directors with the right behaviours so decisions, robust decisions can be reached. And there's the value-adding boards where every member on the board needs to add value. And this presenter really had a strong view on the third kind of board, and he said he only goes on boards where he's adding value, and very often the sorts of boards he's going on have got a particular strategy for 18 months, and they hire a director with the understanding that they're only going to be on the board for 18 months while the strategy is carried out, and then they would rotate off and someone else would come on. So he's very much that sort of director. But I think in fairness, most boards are actually a combination of those three. They've got structural things they want to cover, they've got behavioural aspects they want to cover, and they want everyone to be evaluating. So I think that's probably, to be fair. When we when we had our risk management half day, we did various things. Actually, one other thing about the course is they had all the attendees. There were 30 attendees, and they had five tables of six, and they swapped your tables every time too, so you got to know different people. And there was a lot of table discussion too. So it was interesting to hear viewpoints from other people. Some of the group taking the course were managing directors, so they're kind of familiar with the CEO position, but not so familiar with their director aspect of their position now, and they wanted to make sure they understood what their director responsibilities were too. There were some people from government, and you know, government doesn't have boards, but they have committees which have a similar sort of role to boards. And then there were people like me who were seeking to change their career direction into non-executive director positions. And we had one table discussion on the risk day where the presenter said to us, each table needs to formulate a risk score out of 10 as to how dangerous the sport would be that people at the table would be willing to partake. So each table had to decide out of 10, how risky a sport are we willing to undertake? So when we started discussing it and people started sort of saying, oh, well, I'd probably be a 6, and someone else said, I'd probably be an 8. And I said, well, we should just say what that actually means. I've got to think of a sport that's a 10, you know, is that, diving without aqua gear down to, 50 metres, whatever they do nowadays. You know, is that a 10 or off-piste skiing or something? And then what's tennis? Is tennis a 4 or something? So we sort of decided what we thought a sport at 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 would be. And then each person around the table gave a sort of score as to how risky a sport they would do. We came up with our average. So when we reported back to the presenter, one table was maybe 5.4, and one table was 4.2, and one table was 6.4. So when we reported back, we were the last ones to report back. I was the reporter, and I said, well, what we did is we decided what categories the sports would go in, and then we came to our conclusion that we would be a 6.4, and she said, what have you done? You've created a risk framework. You can go home now. And we were the only group that did that, actually. So maybe that was my good actuarial training that made me do that. So after doing the ARCD course, you have the option to take an exam and assignment, and if you're successful in those, you can get a qualification called a graduate of the AICD. So I was successful in the exam and assignment, so I'm now a GAICD, and potentially, after being a director for 5 years, I could apply to become a fellow of the AICD. So potentially I could be two fellows. I could be a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and a fellow of the Institute of Company Directors. So we'll see, but that's, through a nomination process in 5 years' time.
I'll just add to what Elaine said, the AICD. I was delighted that she covered it very thoroughly because it is a wonderful organisation. And David Minty, who's sitting here in the front row, is actually on the board of New South Wales, AICD, and like Anthony, is very heavily involved in the not-for-profit sector as a director. I'd like to speak briefly on the subject of how to perform well as a non-executive director. I'm not sure whether I have the right to speak on this, but I'll give it my best shot. The starting point, like most things, is that you learn after a while that your current approach isn't as good as it might have been. And I've learned that in two particular ways over the years. Probably more, but these are the ones I'd like to emphasise. The question of how to read board papers. Now, this is relevant for all of you in whatever capacity you have as a reader of stuff. And that is, now, whenever I read a book, whenever I watch a TV show that has any substance to it, or whenever I read board papers, the core question for me is, well, so what? What out of this stuff actually matters, has materiality, will change my perspective on things. Years ago, as a director, I always thought I was doing... anybody who worked with me on a board knew that I did a thorough job. I would always read my board papers and I'd always have some hopefully sensible questions, etc. But I didn't do the follow-up bit of going back over the board papers when I'd gone through them thoroughly and then saying, well, okay, so what, and coming up with the three or five or whatever things that really mattered. The second bit was I always thought I was very diligent by arriving on time for meetings and staying till the end of them. And what I've learned subsequently is it pays to arrive early and it pays to stay on after if you can, because that's when you might actually learn the best bits. For example, I don't know, any of you been to hear, you're probably all working too hard to make it to the ABC on a Friday afternoon to go and hear Thank God It's Friday live. But if you go there, they're on for the hour, but from 4:45 they're there sort of warming up and getting each other in the right mood. So that's when all the dirty jokes come out that can't go on the radio after that and so on. And then they stick it there for another quarter hour or so afterwards. So that's where you actually get all the best bits. And maybe sometimes with board meetings or what's happening within a company or something, that can actually be when it happens. So, and the same can apply in your roles as executives. Don't necessarily just dash from meeting to meeting, arrive on time, leave, you know, et cetera, which I used to do. A key thing if you're involved with a company is be engaged with it. Go to whatever functions you can make. Go to subcommittee meetings that you're not necessarily on, just to see how they function and they are functioning properly. For example, I'm a director of Milton Corporation, this listed investment company. I'm not on the investment committee because I'm a really bad picker of stocks, but I do go to the investment committee meetings as often as I can because I just like to see how they're functioning and so on. And it's easy to be engaged with a business if it's a fun one. And one of the things that excited me about some of the businesses I'm involved with, your kids can't relate to. For example, I'm involved with a reinsurer. Your kids don't really get their mind around reinsurance that easily. But I used to be the chairman of Just Group, which had, you know, Just Jeans and JJ's and Portman's and Jackie E and so on. But the two businesses that the kids really loved were Peter Alexander and Smiggle. And but being able to go shopping with the kids and so on, it added and with my wife, it added a dimension to it, which they were shocked how long I could spend in dress shops. I can tell you. A key thing about performing well as a non-executive director is to be curious, to be supportive of management, but through that, earning the right to ask challenging questions in the right way. To not just read the board papers the night before, because if you just read them the night before, you've got no opportunity to warn the management that you're going to ask them question X that they mightn't like, or to consult with some of your other directors beforehand. And the other part of it is to be on the lookout for dangerous signals within a company. And I'll give you some examples of those. Getting bad news late. Late monthly accounts, responses from management that are superficial or evasive, CEOs minimising your exposure to other levels of management, absolutely extraordinary returns on funds invested, poorly prepared or late board papers, excessive affluence, resistance to the termination of poorly performing executives, high staff turnover or low engagement, complacency and poor habits that arise during good economic times, and we're seeing the reciprocal of that now, and executives seeking to move the goalposts after they've kicked the ball.
I'm going to talk about dealing with the board as a consultant. So in my roles, I spent a lot of time presenting to boards and in discussion with boards, obviously on this side of the boardroom table as opposed to that side of the boardroom table. And I guess just over the years, I've learnt more and more how to present to boards, how they really, you know, they read their board papers diligently and read the whole actuarial report, but what really needs to be there is the five key issues. What are the five key things? You know, and it could be five key good news items. I mean, that's okay. It doesn't have to be five problems. But, you know, usually when you undertake an actual analysis, there are kind of five key things that are top of mind that you've come across in undertaking your analysis, and that's what the board wants to know. What are the five key implications of the work that you've done? So I think that having been on this side of the boardroom table and over the years learning more and more about how best to get my message across to directors, I think that that is useful when you're on the other side of the boardroom table, because you will have, you know, management presenting to you and consultants presenting to you, and I think knowing how you want the presentation shape to make them most useful for the board is actually a useful piece of knowledge to have. So I do think that learning to present well to boards is useful, again, on the other side of knowing how information should be presented, and also allowing you then to ask the right questions. And I think, you know, that's what I found over some years of boards asking questions, that's led me to try and preempt some of those questions with my presentation, because I know what they're going to ask and then I've really got something prepared. And again, even the reviewing actuary role is something that was a different aspect again under the general insurance regime, where at the board meeting there might be the appointed actuary and the reviewing actuary, and the board often likes to hear from both. And then the appointed actuary will have their key issues, and then the reviewing actuary will have their key issues. So I do think that that's an aspect that is very good of actuary. I think over the years actuaries have been getting better and better at that, and I think it allows boards to then be in a much stronger position to know what the important strategy implications are going forward.
All right, well, we're in the home straight. I'm going to talk about dealing with the board as executive. And the first thing that I would say is I think it's very important to know the whole board, particularly in the not-for-profit world with a very big board. You can find yourself in a position where you're focused on particular individuals, but it's important to build a relationship with everybody on the board and know where they're coming from. And I would say that the key thing for me is I would never go into a board meeting trying to get an important decision ratified without knowing where everybody's coming from, without having spoken to them first, and without, in effect, the decision having been made outside the boardroom. The last thing that I want is a difficult discussion in a boardroom, because it blows up in your face. It goes completely wrong. You have to go into a board meeting, in my opinion, knowing exactly where everybody's going to come from. There may be people who want to make their points, but you kind of have to know that in the end, the consensus will form around a decision that I want them to ratify, for example, and the people who are outliers to that decision will accept the fact that the majority have made that decision. So I think being prepared and doing that work and socialising decisions and working the board, if you like, is extremely important. Now, Ian also asked me to make some comments about the chairman-CEO relationship. The thing that I would say is that to me, as Chief Executive Prostate Cancer Foundation, that CEO-chairman relationship is the most important relationship in my organisation. The organisation can't function without a good relationship between the chairman and the CEO, and I know perfectly well that if there's a fight between the chairman and the CEO, the chairman's going to win. So it's important for me to maintain a strong working relationship. Now, Elaine talked about the mixture if you're a professional director of for-profit and not-for-profit roles, and I think she's got it pretty right, because what you've got to remember is you don't get paid for being a director of a not-for-profit, so you don't want to take four of them and one of the for-profit roles. My chairman is a prostate cancer survivor, very outspoken on it. He effectively does two jobs, his day job and his job as chairman of my organisation, and I have to say I spend a considerable part of my working life in his company, and so it is very important to have a good relationship with him. I was in New Zealand at Prostate Cancer Foundation in New Zealand's annual conference with David and his wife Pam over the weekend. I'm going down to Melbourne this afternoon to a conference that David will be at and having dinner with him this evening. It just is incredibly important to build a strong relationship, and I think one of the things that's important is not to let that relationship, if you like, get too strong and too friendly. I think it's important for him as chairman to have some, to have the distance to be able to go, I don't agree with what you're doing, but it is important to have a very, very strong working relationship.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks, Elaine. That as Anthony indicated, is the end of the home straight. So now we're open for questions, but thank you for your patience in listening quietly for an hour. It's now your turn to either ask questions or to contribute, because I know there are people in this room who have significant experience that they can contribute to this discussion. We've got a couple of microphones. I think it's best if the three of us will sit down here, but whoever's answering the question can stand up at the time so those at the back can see us. And then we'll distribute the other microphone somewhere in the crowd so you can use it. It's important that you do use it because the session is being recorded.
They're on.
Ian, Dennis Wilkinson. Look, thanks very much for what I thought was a fascinating presentation. One of the things that a number of boards have commented on over recent times is the very difficult line of that point between what is management and what is the role of board. And the fact that seems to be changing on a fairly regular basis as new legislation comes through, as regulators require more boards. And how difficult, I'd be interested in your views of how difficult you find that line, and whether as actuaries coming from executive roles into boards would find that even more difficult to deal with, because there would be a tendency to want to stay in the detail as opposed to the higher level strategy area.
I happened to be somewhere yesterday actually being interviewed for a non-executive role as chairman of a company, and I was asked the question, well, do I see strategy as a management responsibility or a board responsibility? And in the instance of strategy, my answer was, I'm sorry, I'm not obeying my own instructions here, my answer was that if you've got management of the quality you would like to have in a company, then I believe strategy should be a management-led initiative generally, with challenge, significant challenge, perhaps significant input, and ultimately endorsement from a board. But I think if you think that you really need to have strategy as a principally a board responsibility, well, I think you've got the wrong management. That's just one example. On the area of, say, capital, in the context of current changes in regulation, my interpretation of what's happening there, and I stand to be very quickly corrected if I get this wrong, but how I'm reading it is that it's not making a significant change in who might be putting their fingers on a calculator to work something out. But what it's changing is the extent of responsibility awareness and then responsibility and judgment, etc., which is placed on the board in making a considered commitment that, yes, we back those numbers or think the following change should be made. So, and I think that's where most things should happen in a company which has the resources to afford good management.
Well, I might say it the other way around, which is I agree with that. I think for me, I would, you know, I believe that me and my management team should be driving the strategy, but I also believe that the board need to be fully engaged and to understand it and understand what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, what I can say is I'm very fortunate in particularly our chair and deputy chair that they're actually very thoughtful about that boundary. You know, sometimes they're standing there shoulder to shoulder with me, and sometimes they go, no, we should step back. And so I think it's actually important that the board are thoughtful about the difference between management and the board and know when to be involved and kind of interventionists and know when to stand back. And, you know, I think that's important from a management point of view as well. I think, you know, some people have said to me, well, Anthony, your board is too involved. They're getting involved in management. And I don't see it like that at all. I think the fact that the board are fully engaged with what we're trying to do. And, of course, you know, by and large, they're prostate cancer survivors. They're committed to the cause, so it's a little bit different. But the fact that they're fully engaged and they understand what we're trying to do and some of the difficulties of trying to do what we're trying to do is actually very helpful.
Fenton Thornton from CBA. Up until about 8 months ago, I was a consultant in advising on superannuation funds, and so spent a lot of my time in boardrooms as well, particularly with superannuation trustee boards. And one thing that I've observed over my years is that, to Anthony's point, it's great to have an engaged board. It absolutely is. However, my question really comes to the frequency of board meetings, what that means for management teams, particularly small management teams, as they try to prepare for those board meetings. And then on top of that, when you have trustee directors who are quite close to the action, so to speak, what you find in practice is that the management team and the support staff react to those sorts of requests and find it hard to push back on boards and prioritise. And so my question really is around that whole area of, is the frequency an issue? Are board meetings sometimes too frequent? And then the additional emphasis that puts on staff and maybe sometimes distracts them from what their real purpose is. Some comments on that.
Well, I think it comes back to my point about making sure that you've socialised what you're trying to do with the board. I mean, I think if you've got good engagement with the board and you've got a good strategic plan and a good business plan which has been well presented, well explained and understood, I don't think you should really find yourself in that sort of situation. I mean, I'd like to think that the requests that we get from our board... I mean, I won't say that we don't get requests where we all go, oh, no, you know, but because we all do, that's life. But we don't get kind of requests from the board where we think, well, what's that all about? And I think that's about creating a good dialogue. We have board meetings four times a year, but, I mean, I meet with, we have more frequent subcommittee meetings, and I meet with the chairman and the deputy chairman once a week on a formal basis, and there wouldn't be, there wouldn't be a day go by where I don't speak to my chairman, and I think, and probably similarly with the deputy chairman, now that might be a bit more engaged than you'd expect in a for-profit board, I know that it is, but I think that having that, you know, sense that we're all in the tent together, we're all working on this, we're not kind of at loggerheads with each other, I think that's, you know, I've worked very hard personally to build that relationship with the board, and I know, you know, I respect the fact that the board worked very hard to build that relationship the other way around, and I think if you do that, it shouldn't be a problem.
I think the main thing is that I agree that there is a significant potential problem there in companies or trustee boards or whatever, and you can have bits of paper that were produced 5 years ago for some reason getting perpetuated in the board papers and so on. So to have a regular review, perhaps once a year, of, well, what's actually in the board papers is of one challenge to that issue. And the other is to have a once a year at least review of performance, of the board, which links into, well, the papers that are being produced when particular subjects are being discussed in the annual cycle of the board. Monthly meetings are a big ask, but in many businesses, you really need to have meetings that regularly in order to be in touch with the pulse of the business. In some financial institutions or superannuation funds, I suspect that's not the case. But in operating businesses like that metal bashing business I was talking about earlier, that things to do with that could change very rapidly. Peter? No.
I've seen a few non-profit boards and boards of health funds and so on over the years. I was on Macquarie University Council for a while too, and I've been on the Institute of Actuaries here. My observation is that there's been a change in attitude to conflict and debate, and that some years ago the relationship between the chairman and the CEO was a very important one, as you say, but the chairman's role was to keep the debate among the directors within the board and then to communicate that to the management. and make sure that it stayed in the board, but that debate was a very healthy thing, and that having a difference of views was a very healthy thing, and having a process in place that enabled everybody to basically debate things out in an exhaustive manner with committees or subcommittees or whatever until a consensus emerged naturally. The modern view, however, it seems to be a lot less patient of debate. And the notion that somebody... it's almost like a groupthink mindset now. And my observation of boards is that if somebody does keep asking questions or keep questioning something, they actually get sidelined. And boards do tend to fall into this role of just repetitive, doing the same thing again and again and again. And the only way in which they seem to refresh themselves is by bringing new directors in. And that seems to be very common today. And I'd be interested in your comment on the role of conflict within the board. Is it a creative thing, or is it, as the gentleman in the non-profit thing said, something to be avoided in the board? It's all done in drinkies outside.
Well, Peter, I think it's a very good idea to bring in new directors as a way of making sure that the board doesn't keep doing the same thing over and over again. It's an interesting comment, the group think versus healthy debate, and it's certainly been around for decades, that sort of, you know, that thinking, and even, you know, some political persuasions of more group think and more individual thinking. I mean, that has certainly been around for a long time. So it's interesting, the observation that you've made, that group think is coming back again, because certainly the discussions that I've been involved with for potential roles on boards have been very focused on the fact that the board is looking for diverse views, they're looking for healthy debate, they really do want to try and make sure that problems and issues with a particular decision are raised before the decision is made. You know, it really seems to... my impression is certainly that boards want to do the best they can to make the right decisions and not fall into a trap of making a decision because all the members of the board think the same way. They all graduated from, you know, Cranbrook in the same year, and they're just not thinking of other issues that customers might raise or something that... You know, it just seems to me that boards are very much thinking around having some diverse skills and diverse thinking and healthy debate, but of course wanting to reach a decision in the end.
Actually, Peter, I thought, as you led into that you were going to make the point the other way around, to be honest, because my impression is perhaps the other way around. But I suppose it's just based on individuals' experiences. I don't feel today in most of the environments I'm in that there's any discouraging of debate. There's significant encouragement of it, whereas I'd suspect in earlier days when less had been talked about to do with good governance, diversity, groupthink and all these sorts of issues, I would have thought there was less awareness of it, but we all just see our individual situations. Or maybe I'm the guy causing what you're...
I don't know.
Can we chat on to that question? Just how much of it is that it's expected to happen outside of the board meeting as opposed to in the board meeting?
Yeah, I think that's a core comment. I think my personal view of the preferred model is that it should happen inside the board meeting, but with somebody having previously rung the chairman or the chief executive and say, look, the proposal that's up tomorrow for us to spend $1 million on this, I have a significant problem with because of A, B and C, and I intend to raise that so that everybody's on notice that what was recommended by the management doesn't enjoy unanimous support and there needs to be some rigorous debate. So I think your point's totally right. Sorry, I'll just say, please... when you need to leave, I think we as members of your little forum are happy to stay here for quite some time if you wish to continue, but if you've got to leave, please do.
Thanks, Ian. David Minty, just a couple of comments on matters related to being a director.
I think that the point that Peter's raised and which Ian has responded to is actually a very important part of understanding what is different about being on a board versus being an executive. And one of the most important things, of course, is that while you are there and you've been elected onto a board or appointed onto a board, you are there working with a group of people. You know, you are working both with your fellow board members and you're also working with the management team. Now, obviously, organisations differ. And when you look at some not-for-profits, you'll find the board, in fact, is doing a lot of management because they don't have any other resources. They are the resource. And so typically, you know, your local club, you know, your church groups and things like that, you'll find a lot of that sort of thing goes on. And there is a spectrum because over time, organisations do develop. And I imagine when PCFA was first established, it did not have a chief executive officer. You know, the committee basically did everything themselves. And then as the organisation grew, you know, and as its needs changed, obviously what it did and how its board operated and with the management team, you know, changed. But having said that, I think the way in which people relate to one another and are prepared to be open and discussing is very important. On the one hand, as Andrew said, he'll tend to go to his directors with a plan that he's already discussed with them. And so, you know, if you've socialised a plan in that way, you know, you would expect that there may not be a huge amount of debate at the particular session. On the other hand, if Andrew or someone else goes, you know, behind people's backs or tries to cut off a particular director, as Ian said earlier, one of the great that's really an indicator of dysfunction, and that sort of dysfunction is the sort of thing that eventually destroys companies, destroys organisations, because people need to be able to trust one another. And I guess the biggest thing that I've learnt in being a director of a fairly significant not-for-profit over a number of years now is that you have to have that trust in your fellow directors, you have to have that trust in your management team, and if you can't maintain that trust, then you need to do something about it. You need to address it with the individuals concerned, you need to address it with the chairman, you may need to, you know, the board may need to address it with the management team, or you may need to take the decision to leave that particular board. You shouldn't ever do that sort of thing lightly, but it is certainly something that you need to bear in mind that at some stage you may need to do. And we've seen over time there are a number of directors of listed and not-for-profits who have made those decisions. Sometimes, in retrospect, they've looked to be very silly to do that. At other times, of course, the company has gone bust shortly thereafter because of exactly the things which they raised. So again, it's very important when you think about taking up a role of a director. Yes, a non-executive director role is one where you don't have that full-time involvement. You still need to be passionate about it, I think. In fact, I don't think you could be a director of a company and not be passionate about what that company is doing. If you were, you wouldn't really be doing your job, because part of it is not just being around the boardroom table, it's also participating in the other aspects of what the business does, understanding it, being out there with the staff, knowing what's going on, that sort of thing. So I will endorse the comments that have been made about AICD. A number of years ago, I was involved as an actuary with a small company called James Hardy. Some of you will recall that the Institute pinged me for my behaviour there, and I think that was, in retrospect, probably the right thing that they did. Having said that, I was challenged by that to, in fact, undertake the company director's course to understand a little bit more about what it was that this group of people who had employed me at one stage as their consultant had done. And, of course, at the end of the day, I probably recognised the fact that the board, despite the responsibility with which they've now been held, probably had very little knowledge of what was going on at the time. So, again, I would take that as being a warning to each one of us. Don't simply let your management team come to you with proposals about big issues that you don't understand fully and you're not all over. On the one hand, it might look to you like the James Hardy directors got pinged over the press release, and in one sense they did, but that was only, if you like, the tip of the iceberg, I guess a little bit like sending Al Capone to jail for tax evasion as opposed to anything else he might have done. That's not disparaging the individuals concerned, because I think all of them were genuinely trying to do the right thing at the time. It's just that being human, we all make mistakes. Thanks.
David, could I just say thank you for speaking so frankly about that situation? I've had my version of the theme, which I alluded to earlier, where I was a non-executive director of GIO at the time when AMP made a bid for it. And when you go through several years of legal action, it focuses your mind on the liability side of these roles. And I'll answer my own question here, which is, well, okay, at the time, did I decide to give up being a non-executive director? And I concluded that I was a bit like, a neurosurgeon who'd been had one liability claim against them because of having something or other gone wrong in an operation, whether they were at fault or not. I thought, well, this is what I've trained to do. It's what I love. I think I do it well. I'll continue doing it and so on. But I think what's valuable is that people like David and I think myself can frankly speak about the hard ones as well as the ones that go right. And in this sort of role, you get a good mix of both.
Mike Murphy. This is honest. I'm interested in the two points that were made and the relationship between joint responsibility or consideration and individual. Ian, you gave an example of having looked at the skills and experience matrix. You had a board that was looking for a logistics expert and an IT expert. And then the other example, of course, about signing accounts and responsibility for every figure or note that's in a set of accounts. And I'm interested in the perspective of the discussions in a room on IT issues or logistics issues or various other issues in that sort of operation and how much you can contribute when you're less than an expert in some of those areas, noting a very good point made by Anthony about the frame of reference that you bring things to is very useful. But then on the accounting side, so there's two questions in there, one about the general discussion on various non-accounting issues and the other bit down on the account side of things. As a avid reader of superannuation accounts and other things that both reader and preparer of, I guess, there's an awful lot of below the line or stuff which is aggregated into numbers which turn up in the accounts. To what extent are the directors, they're certainly responsible, but are able to drill down below the numbers presented to them in a formal set of accounts to various sub-items or whatever, how much they can query, I guess, the management and the auditors in that context?
Mike, I haven't got a very good memory, so I'll be struggling with the two questions, but last thing, you use the words, to what extent can the directors drill down, etc. Certainly I have one golden rule, which is that as a director, I have a right to ask any question I like and for as long as I like about whatever I like to do with the business. Whether it's easy to do that or whether I'm smart enough to actually find the proper question I should be asking is another matter. But I've certainly one company, I used to be chairman of the audit committee at OPSM. And certainly with our annual accounts, with each of the items in the published balance sheet, there were the notes to the account and profit and loss account. There were the notes to the accounts, and then we had a supplementary pack behind that, which gave the breakup of those, the core constituents of each of those items. So I guess it is good practice to provide directors with that, but most companies, I don't know, go to that level. They leave it up to the directors to find the right question or the big items. Re, your other question about liability and responsibility when you have specific skills, and I guess one example of that is this one of we're all financial experts to greater or lesser degrees. To what extent are you more exposed than somebody else if you hold up your hand to be chairman of the audit committee of something? I don't even know the exact answer to that under current court cases and whatever, but certainly my view is that we should take the view that we hold collective responsibility and that I, as a non-IT expert who has sat on some IT committee subcommittees of boards have the same responsibility to ask any questions that I'm uncertain about, partly because I might be able to ask that dumb question which is actually useful, or simply because I might learn through, or somebody else might learn through my curiosity. So I think it's substantively collective responsibility. David's nodding as though that's my comments are somewhat consistent with current rules. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, just very briefly, that your responsibility as a director is the same whether you are the chairman or the chairman of the or the member of the audit committee or whatever else. Now that's what the situation is in law. That doesn't diminish the responsibility of the individual directors. It means that your responsibility as an individual director is the same as the chairman of the company. Now, in some cases, you'll find that the odd judge here or there will say that the chairman of the company had more responsibility. That was because he was probably more involved in a particular aspect, had more direct knowledge. And I'm thinking of one particular case which goes back many years there, the National Safety Council. But in fact, even when you drill down into a lot of this case law, you find there are particular, you know, things which meant that that person put themselves in that situation. But the general thing with a board is that that everyone is equally responsible. That doesn't mean, as I say, that doesn't diminish the responsibility of you as a non-chairman. It simply means your responsibility is the same as the chairman. If the chairman cocks something up and the company screws up, you're part of the board where that happened. So again, always being prepared to challenge what's going on. It can be great to be a non-expert in the area because you can ask the really dumb questions. And sometimes the really dumb questions are the ones that no one's thought to ask before, as I think Mr. Justice Owen might have said in a particular case regarding HIH.
I just want to say that everything we were told in our course is absolutely consistent with what David's just said. Every director has equal responsibility, and it's important to ask questions if you don't understand what's in front of you.
It's the reason I wasn't so forthright on that point at the beginning was I remember a case as well, which was the OneTel case, where I think John Greaves, who was the chairman, and I think might have been chairman of the audit committee at the time or something, I think was dealt with differently, and I don't know why that was.
The facts of the case rather than because of his particular role as chairman as such.
Thank you. I'm just going to do two things, actually. Firstly, before everybody has to leave, I'd just like to thank the panel for their contribution today, because I think we've all found it particularly interesting. So if you'd like to join me in doing that first. Thank you. And I'd take the opportunity to ask a question as well. I just wondered... But if I get the thanks in first... At least I did the thank yous first. You mentioned networking, and I think that is important, and I think, and also a breadth of knowledge beyond our industry. I just wonder if you had any practical suggestions, particularly for people perhaps earlier in their career who are long-term thinking of board and want to do a little bit, in terms of maybe organisations that they should join, types of functions that they should attend, you know, just some practical sorts of things that they could be doing as they start on their journey towards being a director. Thanks.
One of the first things I'd suggest is widen your reading, and particularly, perhaps most obviously, of the financial press, and develop a genuine interest, particularly if your interest happens to be ultimately to being a director of for-profit organisations. Well, there are some magazines or newspapers in Australia which keep you in touch with developments in amongst listed companies, etc. You know, be a reader of The Economist or things like that. So that's one aspect I'd certainly encourage. The other is, and Jenny's referred to that, is to over time widen your networks and just be comfortable engaging with all sorts of people on all sorts of subjects, whether you're an expert in them or not. And after a while you become an expert at nothing.
So I also wanted to add to be involved in things at the Institute, because the Institute does cover a wide range of topics, and Institute committees, I think, are a useful way of practicing working with groups and discussing issues and trying to be persuasive to bring everyone around to your way of thinking. So I think that the Institute itself can be a very good practice ground, as well as then making your contribution back to the Institute, as we all need to do. No, they haven't.
Other questions? No? We've exhausted everybody. on behalf of our little team, thank you for your interest in the subject. I'm sure you're coming from all sorts of different directions at it, but I hope that somewhere today has been helpful in your actuarial careers and your potential career one day as a non-executive director. Thanks.